today's episode, we have Thomas Neumann from the Avere as our guest. Maybe Thomas, you can introduce yourself briefly.
Yeah, sure. My name is Thomas Neumann. I work as policy manager at Avere, the European Association for Electromobility. I have been with the association for about 2 years or a bit over 2 years now. In my function, I kind of lead the policy work of the association. So I monitor what's going on in Brussels in terms of policy developments that are relevant to e-mobility, feed it back to our members, lead the internal working groups together with my colleague, and then feed our members' feedback back to European decision makers, so more the classical, advocacy tasks that I'm also taking. I can also introduce Avere briefly, maybe. Avere is the European Association for Electromobility, founded in the late 70s. But in recent years, on a rapid growth trajectory, because obviously electromobility is currently on a breakthrough. We advocate in Brussels on behalf of the entire ecosystem of electromobility, on behalf of both industry and users, national associations, think tanks. So we really try to represent the entire ecosystem and try to get policies in place that are conducive and helpful for the breakthrough and establishment of e-mobility in Europe.
So who are the actually members? You're advocating for the whole ecosystem. Who are the members of the organization?
So there's basically two pillars. The more traditional pillar are national associations. So in a way, Avere started out as an association of associations, bringing together national associations that represent e-mobility. Most of them represent industry. So there's direct industry members, companies that are active in the space, like car makers, charging infrastructure producers, etc. And some of them actually represent users. So for example, the Norwegian EV Association, last time I checked, it was 140,000 drivers, but they're rapidly growing as well, so that might be outdated. So we're representing quite a significant number indirectly as well of actually drivers and everyday users of EVs, and have them on the table as well in our internal working groups. And then we have direct members, industry members, all kinds of company sizes, from kind of global players to smaller SMEs that composes of, on the one hand, vehicle manufacturers, so OEMs like Tesla, Rivian, Lucid, XPeng, NIO, Polestar, for example, as well, but also the value chain that supports this. So for example, Albemarle as a major lead frame producer. And then on the other hand, we have the infrastructure members. Those are charging point operators, e-mobility service providers, but also charging point manufacturers. And then we have a few, for example, even research institutes as well in the membership. So it's quite broad. And as you can see, we represent really the entire ecosystem and any kind of business that's related to e-mobility. For example, one aspect I also forgot actually was users such as enterprise or Uber, so institutional ride hailing and car rental users as well.
All right. So from 1970s until today, a lot of has changed, and especially in the past years, a lot of growth in that area. What are kind of the hottest kind of sort of key focus areas you are working at the moment?
That's a broad question, because indeed there's so many relevant proposals that have gone on and are still going on throughout the past months. So I will start maybe with the vehicle side. And there, what's very important in our view are emission standards. We have the emission standards for light duty vehicles already. So the cars and vans, basically the passenger cars that people drive every day, where there is now a reinforced trajectory, and this has been agreed, that manufacturers have to reduce their emissions over time. And in 2035, there will be a de facto ban on selling cars that aren't zero emissions. So every new car in 2035 will have to be electric or hydrogen. We don't believe in hydrogen particularly, but any zero emission solution. You cannot sell an internal combustion car after 2035 as a general rule. We are now moving into the same thing for heavy duty vehicles, so your trucks, your buses. The Commission has proposed, again, an emissions trajectory with the headline target being a 90% reduction of the new truck fleet in 2040. So this is currently under discussion. It's a bit earlier stage. The car and van ones are finished, but the heavy duty ones are still, in an early stage and will go through the institutions in the coming months. On the other hand, we have been discussing very prominently the AFIR, that's the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure Regulation, which aims to make sure that there is a comprehensive charging network all throughout Europe that grows with the uptake of electric vehicles, and that covers the main motorways so that long distance traveling becomes easy and convenient. Also, regulate certain things such as, you know, payment methods, consumer information, so that charging is really convenient for users and easy to understand and transparent. So that's the idea, very important to enable, obviously, with charging infrastructure, the rollout. But then I could mention the lots of other proposals. We have the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, which is more crucial for private charging, because a lot of charging actually happens in private spaces, not in public. It's not like internal combustion cars where you need a gas station. It's actually usually most convenient to recharge at your home or at your workplace, for example. That's where the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive comes in. We had the battery regulation, which is finished, which makes sure that we have a sustainable battery production in Europe and a competitive one as well. We are now moving into the Critical Raw Materials Act, aiming at securing critical raw materials such as lithium, such as rare earths, such as cobalt for the EU's transition. We have the Net Zero Industry Act, which aims to incentivize clean manufacturing. The Renewable Energy Directive, which aims to green the energy grid. So you see, there's a lot going on right now. And yeah, it's really kind of a holistic perspective that the Commission is taking with its Green Deal, trying to really activate all levers that can decarbonize the EU economy and transport in particular.
Yeah, I think Rika made some look at the, what is the current state of the kind of electric vehicle market in the Europe. How it was, Rika, where are we at the moment?
Yeah, I have a bit of data here with me. Sales of the electric cars in Europe has been experiencing a consistent rise annually. In 2022, so last year, 2.6 million electric cars sold in Europe, a 13% increase from the year before. And the European Union accounted for 76% of the total sales in Europe. Share of electric car in the EU reached 21% out of the total car sales in 2022. And overall, there were about 7.8 million electric cars on European streets in 2022, more than four times the stock in 2019. And the EU 27 accounted for 73% of that total stock. As for the type of electric car, BEV or a battery electric vehicles constituted 44% of the total electric car stock, and the rest belong to PHEV. And now for the charging infrastructure, as of the end of Q1 2023, the EU had a total of 498,000 charging points, with a distribution of 89% AC chargers and 11% DC chargers. I guess, Thomas, you know about all these numbers already.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so, I mean, one good source actually for these kinds of numbers is EAFO, the European Alternative Fuels Observatory. I don't know whether you took them from there.
Yes, exactly. I took numbers from there for the charging infrastructure.
Yes, exactly. So that's the Commission's official portal where they monitor the uptake of alternative fuels, in particular electricity, throughout Europe. It's a very useful source for all your listeners. Big recommendation.
Yeah, you mentioned about this 2035 deadline on the internal combustion engine car sales. And there has been some discussions now that some people would like to see that timeline to extend it. What kind of thoughts you have about that? Is it too soon, in a sense, 2035?
In our view, it's nearly too late. So the reason behind the 2035 date is that a car that is sold nowadays in the European Union on average stays on the road for about 15 years. So any new car that is sold will still be on the road 15 years later. And that's actually only in the EU, because sometimes it gets exported, you know, outside the EU and stays on the road there for much longer as well. The EU has given itself the legally binding target, and that it needs to achieve to also be consistent with its climate obligation, with the Paris Agreement, etc. We are all seeing the climate emergency. We are seeing floods. We are seeing heat waves in Spain right now. We are seeing wildfires in increasing frequency every year. So there's really no time to lose. And in order to achieve these climate targets, the EU has given itself the legally binding obligation to be climate neutral in 2050. So if you kind of calculate back from 2050 and you take these 15 years that a car is on the road, then you need to stop selling polluting cars in 2035 so that by 2050 they get off the road again. If you continue to sell into the 2040s, then by 2050 these cars will continue to be on the road and will continue to pollute. So that is why this date for 2035 is so crucial. What we have had in Brussels now as well is a big discussion fueled by mainly the German government over so-called e-fuels. Those are, in theory, carbon-neutral fuels that many can claim, or many claim, can save the combustion engine because on these combustion engines can be run carbon-neutrally. There's big problems with this, however. The main one is, and most of them bind back to this, energy efficiency. These carbon-neutral fuels are very energy-intensive to produce. And basically, if you run a car on a battery directly with you know, battery electric propulsion, then 80% of that energy actually goes into propelling the car forward. If you take an e-fuel, then 18%, not 80, but 18, is used to propel the car forward. And so you would need basically four times as much renewable energy to run the fleet on e-fuels. And you know that renewable energy is already a scarce resource. We're already struggling to, you know, build it out quickly enough. There's a lot of local resistance to wind parks, etc. So basically, we don't have the energy to run the fleet on e-fuels. With that also comes obviously massive costs because they are expensive to produce. And they're just not a mass market solution. There might be a niche for certain Porsche drivers that are wealthy enough to afford them. They are also, honestly, the capacities that we can produce more urgently needed, for example, for planes, for ships, for certain industrial applications. So the really only way to decarbonize passenger transport that's affordable, that's, for example, also doesn't produce tailpipe air pollution, because the local pollution and local emissions of an e-fuels or internal combustion vehicles are exactly as high as a traditional internal combustion vehicle. The only solution that does all of that, and that is available right now at scale, is e-mobility. And given the timeline to 2050, we have to go the latest in 2035.
There has been like, especially the earlier episode, we discussed about the hydrogen in the trucks and so on. But that is basically electric, but a different way to storing the energy for certain use cases. But then do you believe that the 2050 will happen, that all the road transportation is at least decarbonized, if not fully electric?
We would very much hope so. Obviously, we see now a certain backlash against the Commission's green agenda, and actually against certain proposals that were already agreed. So, you know, certain forces in Brussels, lobby groups, the conservative groups in Parliament, parts of them at least, are pushing back. That being said, it's a necessity. We see the consequences of climate change already. Every summer, you know, you saw the spring floods in Germany a few years ago. You see now the massive heat wave in Spain impacting farmers there quite adversely. There is really no alternative to doing this. And so, well, today our answer would be, of course, yes, we believe in it. But it's not so much a question of believing. We have to manage this transition.
And there is a kind of in the progress there, we can see that there is a differences in the Europe, especially the West and East and North and South. I think Rika had some insight on that.
Yeah. So electric cars account for 21% of new cars registered in the EU in 2022, but they only have a market share of 9% or less in more than half of EU member states. The top five countries with highest electric car share are located in the northern and western part of Europe, namely Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the Netherlands, and Germany. On the other hand, many Eastern and Southern European countries such as Greece, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Poland, Croatia, Czech Republic, and also Romania, share of electric car is less than 9%. Of course, unsurprisingly, this gap issue is related to income. The top five countries have an average net income of more than 3,000 euro, while the other countries with less than 9% share of electric car have an average net income of 13,000 euro or less.
Yeah, there is obviously big regional differences, but to a degree, this is normal. Yeah. You've already said that it's related to income, and there will always be lead markets. Right now, electric vehicles have still a higher upfront cost. They actually are cheaper to run over their life cycle because basically electricity is cheaper than fuel. But you need a certain amount of household income to actually be able to afford a new electric vehicle at least. And then a lot of benefits, you know, for the second and third hand users. But for the first hand user, for the first few years, it will be a bigger financial hit. So obviously, markets where people tend to be more wealthy tend to develop first. That being said, we've already talked about the 15-year life cycle of a vehicle within the EU. These vehicles that are now being sold in, let's say, the Netherlands, will in a few years be passed down to, let's say, Romania. And so the quicker we get these markets in the north and in the west with wealthier consumers, the quicker we get the uptake done there, the quicker this will also pass down to other markets. That being said, there are levers, and they are important to take as well, that will directly incentivize also for these southeastern markets that are maybe a bit slower to develop, that will incentivize uptake there. One very crucial lever in our view are corporate fleets. The majority of cars sold in Europe nowadays is actually not to private households, but to corporations. Those are usually leased for only a few years, 3 or 4 years. They drive more kilometers than the privately owned cars in that time as well, so they have a disproportionate decarbonization impact. And by mandating that companies have to buy their fleets as electric vehicles, as zero emission vehicles, also in, for example, Eastern European member states, one could really stimulate the secondhand market, because after that initial period, the cars come to the secondhand market and are so affordable then for private consumers. So on the one hand, we have levers to close this gap to a degree, but also this gap will come down and it will to a degree also remain. But that's, as we said, normal, and indeed the 2035 timeline basically ensures that because the vehicle fleets tend to be a bit older in the southeast of Europe, that by the time we reach 2050, also there we should have the full electrification.
I was thinking that the issue, like the low incomes and so on, and most of the European countries, I think they have had some kind of incentives also to people to get fully electric vehicles. What do you think? How important are they actually effective? Because there has been, I think, debate also whether they really help the incentives. What there is.
Incentives are definitely helpful because they do help close the gap between electric vehicles and combustion cars. I've already talked about upfront purchase price, right? Especially for private consumers that don't always calculate the entire lifespan. That might be an important factor, how much does it actually cost to buy the car. And if they see the electric vehicle is much, much more expensive and I'm not willing to make the investment right now as a consumer, then that can put them off. So purchase subsidies can help accelerate this transition. We see the cost of batteries and of EVs coming down continually. So that's one thing, one caveat. Basically, the moment that electric vehicles become cheaper, you can phase these subsidies out, because in the end, you shouldn't spend taxpayer money if there's no need to do so, right? So they need to be proportionate and they need to be limited in time until it's kind of self-driven, this uptake, which it will be. And it has to aim at least at closing the TCO gap where it still exists, total cost of ownership. But more importantly, by now, because in most countries, the TCO is already lower. So over the lifetime, the owner saves money. But the purchase price, the upfront price gap, they can help close. And then one second factor is that there are obviously monetary incentives, but there can also be non-monetary incentives, right? So it doesn't probably work for markets where every car is electric. But we have seen, I think it was the Norwegian case, where in the early days, they allowed EVs to drive on the bus lane. So basically drive past a traffic jam. You spend €0, and as long as you don't have that many EVs that this lane would also be blocked, you set a very powerful incentive for people to switch. So there is different ways of incentivizing EV uptake, and especially at the current stage where we need to get scale into the market, they can be very effective. In the long run, obviously they should be phased out.
All right, then, of course, then the EV, the one is to get the enough cars in the sense to the market, and the secondhand market to be also matured, which goes by time. The other thing is the infrastructure itself. And that one is also, if I remember, Rika was checking earlier the data, that one is also a little bit advancing in different speeds in different countries. Was that, Rika, how was the numbers there?
Yeah, that's true. Like the gap issue can also be seen in the deployment of charging infrastructure between the western part of Europe and the eastern part, as well as the northern versus southern European countries. Half of the charging infrastructure is actually located in just two countries, the Netherlands and Germany, which make up only 10% of the EU landmass. And there is also this study from GridX measuring the number of charging points per 100,000 people in the country. So GridX data estimated an average of 92 charging points per 100,000 inhabitants across 28 European countries. And countries with less than 92 charging points, or less than average, are mostly located in the eastern and southern parts of Europe, with Poland, Bulgaria, and Romania having less than 10 charging points per 100,000 inhabitants as per the end of 2022. And as we know that installing a charging station, EV charging station is very expensive. So is there any regulation that is trying to close the gap between the Western and Eastern European countries in terms of charging infrastructure?
So let me give a twofold answer to this. Because on the one hand, yes, there is. That's the good news. There is a regulation, the AFIR, that means the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure Regulation, which sets binding targets for charging infrastructure rollout in every member state. That does it. It does it in two ways. The first one is capacity-based targets, which means that in every member state, for each registered battery electric vehicle, there has to be an additional total charging capacity of 1.3 kilowatts. So basically, the chargers have to follow the vehicles. And also 0.8 kilowatt per hybrid electric vehicle. Then we have distance-based targets. The distance-based targets basically mean that on key highways, on the so-called TNT network, there will have to be charging opportunities every 60 kilometers all over Europe. What does this do? Basically, on the one hand, we have the fleet-based targets that gets rid of the so-called chicken and egg dilemma, right? So the question, what has to come first? Is it the cars? Is it the charging infrastructure? It clearly binds the uptake of charging infrastructure to the cars. And so users can be sure that if they buy vehicles, that there will be additional charging infrastructure deployed. And so we get out of the chicken and egg, and we come to a more of a horse and carriage. The horse, the cars pull the infrastructure, the carriage along, and it grows hand in hand. And on the other hand, we have the distance-based targets. Those basically get rid of range anxiety, because some people still worry, well, okay, if I buy an EV, you know, that has 400 kilometers range, but what if I need to travel 600 kilometers? That makes sure that along motorways, there is always fast charging available every 60 kilometers for people to travel longer distances. And so that's number one of the answer. Yes, there is a regulation, and it will help closing some of these gaps. The second one is that, and we've already talked about capacity and capacity-based targets right now, the number of charging points is not a good metric in our view, because the number of charging points, A, neglects private charging points. It is nearly impossible. There's no good statistics over the EU to see how many private charging opportunities there are. And since there is no good statistics, we don't know. But basically, a lot of people do not actually ever use public charging infrastructure, which is the one on which we have the statistics. So early adopters often have their own driveway. And so in that own driveway, they can have a wall box and they can charge just on their, you know, as they park in front of the house overnight. Especially the wealthy early adopters tend to have this. And so as long as they don't drive extremely long distances, but just commute to work, for example, or go for the shops, they never need to use a public charging point. So private charging infrastructure can make a big difference. And you can see, for example, in Norway, which is one of the lead markets, there's not all that much public charging infrastructure because they have a very, very widespread use of public charging infrastructure, a widespread use of private charging infrastructure. And so the number of charging points completely neglects that dimension. On the other hand, the public charging points themselves, the number is one metric, but you also have capacity and speed. So if you have two fast charging points, they can obviously charge more vehicles in any given hour than 10 slow charging points, right? So 10 slow and 10 fast charging points, or two slow and two fast charging points, are not the same. And that's not to say that fast charging points are per se better. The better metric is really, as I said, total capacity. So, you know, two chargers that are slow or one charger that is double the speed can basically deliver the same amount of electricity. And the slow chargers tend to be cheaper. And for many users, it's the best option to just charge where they park. And so still a country that relies more on these slow chargers and on users charging where they park will end up with a higher number of chargers, whereas a country that relies more on fast chargers, the equivalent to, let's say, gas stations, the quick recharging and then driving on, will have fewer chargers, but will be able to deliver the same amount of electricity to the transport because the chargers are much quicker. So that's a bit of a problem when we talk about number of chargers. But that being said, yes, there is a gap between East and West right now, and AFIR will help close that. And then also as the uptake happens, obviously will be market driven. It is very normal that as long as there are no vehicles, because infrastructure also needs a business case, right? As long as there are very few vehicles in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, there will be no operators wanting to deploy charging infrastructure that won't be used. The early adopters, as I said, tend to rely on the private charging infrastructure. And as the market develops, there will be more infrastructure in these regions as well.
This is very interesting topic and very complicated, I think. Also, the private charging is an interesting point. I haven't charged the car in the public for a few months because I charge at home. But yeah, the thing is, like, the in the Northern Europe, it's very easy to charge car home with relatively high power also. But because our houses are equipped with quite thick power lines because of the heating. But then in the Southern Europe, what I know that private homes might have actually quite limited kind of capacity, but that then goes to the much deeper discussion of the electric grid, that it can be enabled, that the home charging is makes sense.
Yes, indeed. So the grid is a key enabler, and also can be a key blocker in some countries, right? A country with a very stable, well-built out electricity grid will be able to implement this transformation much more quickly. And that's why it's so important that we start also. Right now, the grids are being deployed in a reactive manner, which is something that really slows down charging infrastructure rollout. So an operator has to ask for the grid connection, then the operator of the distribution system looks into it and basically starts working on the connection. Whereas we should really start, especially for the heavy-duty vehicles, the trucks, planning ahead and seeing where do we need these really high-power connections and already put the cables there so that we can build the charging infrastructure down the line. Because otherwise, the waiting for all the permitting for the grid connection can really slow the role of public infrastructure. On the other hand, we have smart charging and vehicle-to-grid, etc. So we have smart technologies that can really help take load off the grid, even where it's not so built out. And even where the grid is well built out, this can really lead to big economic savings, can help maximizing the renewable energy share in the grid, because cars can charge when energy is very abundant, when there's a lot of renewables in the mix and when it's cheap. And they can slow down the charging or even feed back renewable energy to the grid when, let's say, it's cloudy and there is no wind. And they can also kind of distribute their load so that not all the cars charge, you know, hypothetically at the same time and overload the grid, but they can then balance how much each car charges, or basically charge sequentially, basically making sure there is no overloading of a grid that wouldn't be able to handle all cars at once. So we have also smart solutions that can help with this.
Yeah, the one thing about like a public charging, I was looking for like a road trip in Europe, and I figured out that this is a quite painful process because I had to check how to pay in the public chargers in different countries. And I noticed on your website that you have some stamps also on this payment services directive revision, which is currently, I think, being prepared. Is that related also to this kind of the payment dilemma often if you go out of your regular area paying on the public chargers? Because yeah, you mentioned that credit card payment is on the kind of agenda for you guys.
Yes. So the main file for that again is actually AFIR, the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure Regulation, which sets the obligation that users have to be able to pay ad hoc for their charging via payment instruments that are widely available in the union. Which means that basically if you are a user, and you travel abroad or travel outside of your home subscription, your region, travel long distance, etc., charging point operators will have to offer you an option to pay conveniently without, let's say, signing up to their network or getting an RFID card or any of that. And for fast chargers along motorways, and generally for fast chargers going forward, this will have to be, as long as the charger is over 50 kilowatt, this will have to be a physical credit card reader. You can just touch your payment card reader, where you can touch your payment card and you can pay via that. For slower chargers under 50 kilowatt, there are other solutions that are allowed, such as, for example, a little display generating a dynamic QR code, and then you can go online and do your payment transaction there, again, probably using your payment card or, let's say, PayPal or something like that. But it will have to be via widely available payment instruments in the union. And basically, the AVERA stance on this has always been, because we represent industry and users, that we're very in favor of convenient payment for users, and that users should always be able to pay without, you know, subscription or signing up, but that it has to be balanced with the burden and the cost of installing credit card readers. And that's why we're very happy that the Commission has made the differentiation between slow and fast charging, because slow chargers, they tend to be off-street chargers in people's living areas. Normally, people have a subscription there, so people don't really need to pay ad hoc, and credit card readers are quite expensive. And so what would have happened, especially since the chargers are much, much cheaper to deploy, the added impact of a credit card terminal is much, much higher compared to a fast charger that costs hundreds of thousands of euros, where a credit card terminal doesn't make the big difference anymore. And what could have happened if we would have had a mandate for card payment everywhere is that it would have killed the business case for slow charging, which is the most convenient option for many users and the cheapest option on a day-to-day basis. And so we are very happy that the Commission has decided, and the institutions have also gone with that, the Parliament and the Council, to propose and to then agree this differentiated approach. The Payment Service Directive now comes on top, that is about to be revised. That's basically a bit more of a technical question, which is, if you have a credit card reader, do you need a PIN pad? Do you need the physical PIN pad, which again drives up the cost? We would like to see a solution where charging is exempted from the requirements of this directive, which would mean that you can just tap your card and you don't have to have a physical PIN pad to confirm that it's actually you. So that is the Payment Service Directive, but the general principle of ad hoc payment is regulated enough here, and users in Europe can be quite happy, I think, that now they will always be able to pay ad hoc.
Yeah, that sounds very good, because yeah, for me at least, I haven't been worried at all on the longer road trip that I have to spend a lot of time charging. The charging time is not an issue with the fast chargers, but can I pay for it has been always a worry on the road. So that's a good development, I would say, from the usability-wise.
Yes, we very much agree. Very important that charging becomes, well, attractive and actually easier than refueling. We often hear the narrative that it has to be as easy as refueling. We actually disagree. We think it should be easier. And then let's see down the line, you know, there might be innovations such as, for example, plug and charge, so that you don't even have to worry about payment, but you just plug in your vehicle and it kind of recognizes automatically, it pays automatically, and you don't have to deal with the payment yourself anymore. But that's for the moment a bit down the line. Yeah, so let's see how that goes.
And then, yeah, the other thing, from your website, I think Rika looked into a little bit in the renewable energy directive, out of the many directives and so on around this topic. But yeah, Rika had some research and maybe some questions actually regarding to understand better what is it about.
Yeah, not really a research, but maybe questions. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. To my understanding, the renewable energy directive currently is the RED II, right? It's an important element of the Green Deal, European Union's Green Deal, focusing on renewable energy. So this directive is primarily focused on promoting the use of renewable energy sources in various sectors, including in the transportation sector. And as far as I know from your website, AFERA is working on the revision of this directive. Also on the website, there's this specific suggestion to extend the scope of fuel neutral credit trading to include also private charging to properly incentivize and reward all market players. Can you expand a little bit more on this? And how would you think this affects the EV market in the European Union?
Yeah, happy to do that. So let me start by, this has been a very important file, especially for our infrastructure members on the infrastructure side, because it can offer a new revenue and financing source for infrastructure rollout. The institutions have come to an agreement by now, and we're actually quite happy with it. I mean, it could have always been better, but a lot of our suggestions have luckily been heard. Basically, what this directive does on a broader level is incentivize or set a framework for the rollout of renewable energy across the Union. That alone makes it obviously relevant, because zero emission vehicles such as electric vehicles are only really truly zero emissions if they run on renewable energy. They're much better and much lower in emissions, even if they run on actually dirty energy mixes, because of their superior energy efficiency. So they basically lose less dirty energy than traditional combustion cars. But still, for them to really maximize their potential, we need a green energy mix. The other thing, and that's a bit of a technical subcomponent of this regulation, are these fuel neutral credit trading mechanisms. What these do is put an obligation on fuel suppliers to transport. So let's say your Shells, right? They supply fuels to transport, and there is an obligation for them to reduce their emissions by a certain percentage, by a certain amount every year. These mechanisms, for example, are in place actually in Germany or the Netherlands. So the first thing they do is put this obligation on fuel suppliers. What they do is basically give two compliance ways to these fuel suppliers. They can blend biofuels into their supply to reduce their fuels emissions in reality, or they can buy so-called electricity credits to reduce the emissions basically on paper. These renewable electricity credits are allocated to charging point operators or to electricity providers, to anyone who supplies renewable electricity to transport by public authorities. And then there's a trading platform where they can sell these credits back to the fuel suppliers, and the fuel suppliers can buy these credits up and so meet their obligations via buying these credits. And basically what this does is it funnels money from fuel suppliers to the actors that are deploying renewable electricity and charging for electric vehicles. And so it can really help accelerating the rollout. The extension to private charging was one of our asks, and member states will have the opportunity to do that. So that's good for us, a win for us, which basically means that, for example, in Germany, there is currently a mechanism in place so that it's not only for public charging points, but only for private charging points. The problem is if you offer this kind of revenue source only to public charging points, you might direct the markets to a more public model where, for example, private charging might be more efficient. Also, we had the issue of appropriate multipliers, so that basically the value of the credits. I said earlier, an electric vehicle can drive much longer on the same amount of energy. So if there is appropriate multipliers of approximately these four times, that makes sure that the renewable electricity credits are counted four times or counted with the appropriate weighting. That makes sure that the credits are appropriately rewarding that as well. And again, we have a good solution there in the final compromise. A bit of a technical one. I hope it was sufficiently clear, but it sets up this kind of market-based mechanism, making fuel suppliers pay for charging infrastructure. That's just the short version of it.
All right, that was a good explanation. And it sounds like that you guys are working like with a lot of topics at the moment in several areas.
Yeah, quite a busy period, and indeed there is a lot going on.
Yeah, there's like quite many like policies and so on in the EU level and national level, I think, at the moment in kind of under revisions or making.
Yeah, it's part of the Green Deal and Fit for 55. The headline project of this commission, the von der Leyen Commission, has been the European Green Deal and getting the European economy on track for decarbonization, or basically reconciling our economic model and for continued growth, etc., with the need to stop heating the planet and also stop polluting, for example, our water, our air, etc. And so there's a lot of these files that have been presented actually in 2021 as the so-called Fit for 55 package, which hints at the 55% reduction target of the EU by 2030, emissions reduction target. And yeah, all these files fall under this package. Now we're moving actually also into the industrial policy debate. So we've set all the targets. We know where we want to go. We know, for example, that we want to stop selling internal combustion cars in 2035. And now the question becomes, how do we make sure that the workforce has the skills to deploy the charging points and build the electric vehicles? How do we make sure we have the raw materials to build the electric vehicles in Europe? So we're also moving now into the enabling conditions and how to actually make this possible. And it will continue to be busy, I think, for the next few years.
And I guess like now working in the EU with the EU level directives and policies, but then after they are ready, then the nations have to implement it their own legislation. Yes. Is that then when your like a member organizations, national organizations are jumping in and are involved in the process there then?
Exactly. That's where we really rely also on the activity and the great work that our member organizations do at national level. Because a lot of this does actually need to be implemented and transposed at national level, right? So even though European regulations apply directly, so they don't need to actually be translated into national law, they still need to be enforced on the ground, which is on member states. And then you have a directive, the second kind of EU legislation, and actually this needs to be converted into a national law first before it can enter into force. So that's really also where the national policymakers come in as well. And our members are very closely following this on the member state level. And making sure that also there are policies that are conducive to e-mobility. Also, a lot of key levers are not at the European level, right? So subsidies, for example, purchase subsidies are a national decision in the end. And so that is also something that our members engage to a bigger extent than we do, because it's not on the European Commission to decide how much Germany can pay for the purchase of an electric vehicle. They can give guidelines and these kinds of things and can react to distortions of competition. But in the end, the main competence here is still on the national level.
All right, thank you. I think that this was a very good overview of what you are doing. We are mostly talking about technology and zone development in our podcast series, but this was very interesting side that it's not very simple also when it comes to policies and the legislation also.
Can I ask one last question? I want to go back to the earlier part of our conversation when you or Afere, for this matter, doesn't believe in hydrogen. What is the reason for that? Because I believe some people think that hydrogen is a good alternative to supplement battery electric, and it's probably most appropriate for large heavy-duty vehicles.
Yeah. So just to clarify, we don't believe in hydrogen, particularly in passenger cars. When it comes to heavy vehicles, there is a, let's say, residual uncertainty. We see all the numbers that we see in all the studies, serious studies that we see, is that battery electric, even for heavy duty vehicles, is more advanced, more market ready, and the overwhelming majority of cases will be battery electric. So all the regional trucking, etc., will be battery electric, and even a lot of long haul trucking. The main issue with hydrogen really is that it is, and it's a bit like the e-fuels, less energy efficient. It's not quite as bad as with e-fuels, but the same fundamental problem applies. Hydrogen can be produced in two ways. It can be produced from natural gas, so-called gray hydrogen, which is still very emissions intensive. It can be produced with carbon capture and storage, that's blue hydrogen, but that doesn't really fix the problem. And then the only really zero emissions carbon neutral way of producing hydrogen is in electrolyzers, the so-called green hydrogen from renewable energy. But since you are converting renewable energy into hydrogen and then converting it back, you have conversion losses, big energy efficiency losses. And so it's more efficient to use that energy in the battery directly, and that's why battery electricity is, you know, cheaper and more abundantly available. The quantities of green carbon neutral hydrogen that we have in Europe are still very limited, and again, will be in many cases needed for aviation, for industry like steel making, chemical industry, for shipping, for example, as well. So since it's more economical and more market ready, nearly all use cases in our view will be battery electric, especially all passenger cars. We don't see the niche for hydrogen because it makes no economic and energy system sense in passenger vehicles. The EU has left the door open to this, and that's fine, but we think on a market basis, it will not have a future in passenger cars. When we go to trucks, same logic applies. It's a very TCO-driven business. Just because of the limits of physics, battery electric will be the cheaper solution. So when operators can deploy battery electric, they will do so. However, there might be, and we don't know how battery technology will develop, there might be certain, let's say, very marginal use cases where you are transporting extremely heavy goods or going very long distances in very remote regions where there might not be the electricity grid for charging infrastructure, let's say the logging operations in northern Sweden, right? There might be a niche for hydrogen. So we see that there could be a role for hydrogen for specific heavy duty applications, but we don't believe it will be a mass solution, and particularly not for light duty vehicles.
Thank you for the explanation.
It's interesting to see how the world looks, let's say, in 2035, 2040.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks. I would also maybe give one more clarification, actually, on a question you asked earlier or a thing you said earlier, because you were mentioning the numbers on electric vehicles overall in Europe. And that was, I think, putting together hybrids and battery electric vehicles.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
We think personally that hybrids are, if anything, kind of an interim solution, and if that actually there are bad interim solutions. And what we should be focusing on is purely battery electric vehicles. A, because we now know that 2035 we have to go zero emissions, and hybrids still have emissions. So they are not part of the long-term solution. But also because they have more parts, so they're more complicated. Basically, you have two drivetrains in which you can have defects, so they can break down more. They're the worst of both worlds in a way. Most importantly, they're often sold, for example, to company with purchase incentives by national governments because they count as clean vehicles and electric vehicles. So they get sold to these companies with a big environmental subsidy. But in many member states, people get these vehicles with fuel cards as well. And so many, many hybrids are constructed from the start mainly as an internal combustion engine vehicle anyway, with a way under-dimensioned small battery. They can barely go long distances. So most of the time on motorways, for example, they have to use their internal combustion engine. And many of them are never charged. So people get this hybrid vehicle from their company that has been bought with an environmental purchase subsidy, and maybe the company can communicate nicely about how green they are and that they've bought 2,000 hybrids. But the user gets a fuel card. and the user has no reason to ever charge the car. So what basically happens is that many hybrids are being driven around as internal combustion vehicles that needlessly lug a heavy battery around, which makes them less fuel efficient. So in many cases, hybrids are actually worse than traditional internal combustion cars. And so we believe that the long-term solution has to be to go to fully electric vehicles. And if hybrids want to have any niche, then they need to take electrification much more seriously, and the false incentive at national level have to be removed. So we need hybrids that basically can also cover long distances, etc. But in principle, we don't believe in hybrids as a solution. We think that we should really focus on truly zero emissions vehicles.
And yeah, it doesn't definitely probably make the purchase price also like hybrid technology easy to lower when you have two different drive powertrains there.
Exactly, yeah. So they are pricey, they break down more, and they don't have proven environmental benefits.
This was very interesting discussion. Thank you, Thomas, for visiting us.
Thank you very much. And yeah, looking forward to hearing the episode. Thanks.
A special offer for our listeners. We are giving you full access to statistics for 30 days by registering at statson.com with the code STATZON, spelled in uppercase as T-A-T-Z-O-N. And thanks for listening to our podcast. Visit our website and get our Tech 360 newsletters. If you enjoyed this podcast, subscribe, recommend the podcast to your colleagues, friends, and family, and follow us on social media.